Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for November 22nd, 2018, the Sealed Indictment Edition. I just realized today is the 55th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, or the day that the show comes out is the 55th anniversary. Who knew? So, I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in Washington, D.C., my co-hosts, Emily Bazelon of The New York Times and John Dickerson of CBS This Morning, are both in New York. Hello, guys. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hello,
hey,
David.
Happy Thanksgiving.
So we're taping on Tuesday, so who knows what could possibly happen between now and when you hear this, which I hope is not during Thanksgiving, but maybe a little bit before or a little bit after Thanksgiving. Or heck, maybe some families have podcast listening over Thanksgiving. Maybe that
it could save you, you know, having a podcast to tune out to.
That is a good point.
That's right. We could be an island of tranquility. Or like a bouncy castle of fun.
I always think of us as a bouncy castle of fun. That's really what our tagline should
That's
be.
That's what our t-shirt should say.
As you can see, we've got a little pre-holiday joy and boisterousness. We've all been sitting here chit-chatting, but there's serious business to attend to. So we're going to talk about what is going on with the Mueller investigation. Then we're going to talk about the California wildfires, what they portend about life in the next century, and what they portend about life under a drastically changed climate. Then, is Facebook evil or just self-delusional? Are there any other choices we will discuss? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter, of course. And a reminder that coming up soon after Thanksgiving, we have our Conundrum Live show at the Skirball Center at NYU in Manhattan on December 12th, a Wednesday. Some tickets still left at slate.com/live. Simon Doonan, the delightful Simon Doonan, will be our guest for some of that show. And the Conundrum Show, of course, is a chance to discuss the really tough issues, the really complicated moral questions and life questions that you've been grappling with. So you should send us your conundrums, first of all, by tweeting them to us at @SlateGabFest or emailing them to us at gabfest@slate.com if you want some privacy on them. And we noticed someone, some great listener sent around a John Adams conundrum. Did you guys see this?
I love that one.
Yeah.
For so many different reasons.
That was so great.
Let's
save that one, don't you?
Well, no, but let's
just
preview it. We won't discuss it.
Okay.
But it was John Adams writing a letter to Thomas Jefferson asking the question, which is,
would you rather be attacked by a duck-sized George III or 1,000 ducks called George III? Sorry, go ahead.
It would be 100 Hessian-sized ducks or one duck-sized Hessian. No, it was a letter from John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, and it was asking sort of, would you want to live a life where every bit of pleasure is offset by an equal bit of pain. Would that be fair? Like you get a million bits of great pleasure, but in return you must suffer a million doses of pain, of agony that is just as painful as the pleasure is pleasurable. It's an interesting question, but I love the idea that the conundrum is a form that predates even us, even our ancient show. There are conundrums long before us. So we'll grapple with John Adams' conundrum. But please come, slate.com/live to get tickets December 12th in New York. The Mueller investigation fell quiet for some weeks in the run-up to the election. Still quiet, but wiser heads than I say there are signs, there are omens, there are portents, there are tea leaves, there are entrails to be read that Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller is preparing to unveil a series of indictments in the Russia investigation. Emily, what is the evidence? Why is this more than just like reading a feather that fell from the wing of a gull flying over the Temple of Athena?
I think some of it's just wishful thinking on the part of many people who are more than ready for Mueller to make his move, whatever it may be. So some of the tea leaves being read were just like Donald Trump's apparent foul mood last week, which doesn't seem to me like a enormously differentiated piece of evidence, but it was out there and he started tweeting in criticism of Mueller and denying that his choice for acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, that he'd had known anything about Whitaker's views of the Mueller investigation, which seems odd since Whitaker had given interviews and written and talked about his views. So that was a little strange. And what else? Then there are all these like secret court filings going on in the courts in the District of Columbia that, of course, people are speculating they're tied to Mueller. They're not. Some of them are from the Mueller team, but we don't know who they relate to.
Do we know that some of them are from the Mueller team?
Yeah, I think we do know that part. We just don't know who they're about. So there was a lot of speculation that some of it might be subpoenaing Trump, trying to get Trump to testify. But then other prosecutors I was talking to said, no, I don't think that's it. It could be something else. So I think there's just a lot of desire for action. And then, I guess I left out an important thing, which is that a few people, Roger Stone, although he said he was expecting to be indicted a while ago. Then there's that friend of his, Jerome Corsi.
That guy.
Yes. And then the most, I would say, salacious detail is that Don Jr. has been telling his friends that he might get indicted. Now, I have no idea if that's true or not. But, I mean, of course, that is something that the media would gobble up and await for with bated breath, because it would be a very big deal, obviously.
One couple of things I would add is the foul mood was that, yeah, he was specifically targeting Mueller. So the president has tweeted 50 times about Mueller and the Russia investigation. Does that seem like a lot or a little to you?
I think it's a lot. I mean,
it should be zero, right?
Because every time he potentially gets himself in trouble. Also, he hadn't done it for a couple months, right? So it was like a return to form.
Right. So that's just what that question seems to me touches on the larger norm shifting question of the presidency, which is the number should be zero. And yet 50, I thought, oh, well, that's not as much as I thought, because you think that he is constantly agitating about how this is a witch hunt.
But another tea leaf. Sorry, John, I'm interrupting you.
Well, the other thing is that in the Rick Gates, the campaign deputy manager, and then Manafort, there were court filings in which the special counsel said, don't sentence them yet because they're still providing us active information.
Little delays, right? Suggestive delays, like, oh, maybe the government doesn't want to show its hand yet. And then the other report is that Trump's lawyers are almost finished answering the written questions.
Right.
And
right.
So that suggests that's been a long outstanding item on Mueller's checklist.
So explain the don't show the hands part, because what I thought was that they were delaying the sentencing of Manafort and Gates because they were still actively, didn't they claim that they were still actively helping with the investigation, which made me think there are like two clocks here. There's the indictments that have already been sealed, and I want you to explain that. Do you do that? Do you seal indictments so that, let's say Whitaker comes in and fires Mueller, the indictments are sealed, loaded, and ready to go? So even if it fires them, they still go off.
Right. And it means that, exactly, what it means is that there could be indictments that have already they're already in the hands of a judge that we don't know about.
Right. But that's not the only reason why you seal an indictment. There must be lots of other reasons.
In this case, it might be relevant. No, but yes, no, presumably that's not the actual reason. Like, not the proffered reason.
But what are the real reasons?
What are the other reasons you would do it, other than having Mueller, having the fear that you might get fired?
Well, with Julian Assange, who is not being pursued by the Mueller team, I should make clear, that's a separate indictment from the Eastern District of New York. Presumably it was because they were trying to get him extradited or trying to go get him in some way, and they didn't want him to know that they were trying to go get him. That's another reason you steal an indictment. It's someone you don't have your hands on. You don't want them to flee, although Assange is where he is in that Ecuadorian ministry. Another thing related to this that I was thinking about is that, so we're in this moment right now where Whitaker is the acting attorney general. He does not have confirmation from the Senate. He hasn't been nominated, but Trump is still dangling out there that possibility. And I wonder if that makes this a kind of relatively safe moment, or extends the period of safety for the Mueller investigation, right, in the sense that if Whitaker has any prayer of being confirmed by the Senate, he cannot interfere with that investigation. Yeah. And so if he thinks that that's any kind of possibility, he has an incentive to let Mueller be for now.
And there was a report that he told Lindsey Graham that he wasn't going to mess with Mueller, but that's very gauzy. I mean, what is that?
Well, it could be true or not true, but even if it's not true, it's interesting that someone wanted that idea out there, whether it was Graham or Whitaker.
Right, right, exactly. One other thing we should mention is Michael Cohen was in town on Veterans Day.
Oh, yes.
Spotted
at the courthouse
or something, which suggests he's continuing to participate.
I want to, on your point, Emily, I think it's a really good point, and it does seem to me that Whitaker's going out of his way to at least signal publicly, oh, I'm not going to defang this investigation. I'm not going after it, maybe because he wants the big job or maybe for some other reason. It also, I feel like, and maybe I'm always wrong about this kind of stuff, so take it for what it's worth, that kind of priced into the Trump administration and priced into everything that's been going on is basically that, Manafort and Gates are guilty. We'll go to prison. No one cares about them, but that Stone and some other sort of Stone figures around Stone and Don Jr. are all going to go down, and that they've sort of accepted, like, that I'm sure there'll be a vigorous defense of Don Jr., but I think everyone thinks, like, that dude's got trouble. And that as long as the investigation kind of doesn't stretch much beyond that, as long as there isn't a huge amount of other material in time or in scope, that it doesn't stretch beyond that, that's something the Trump administration can more or less live with. The way this is just my gut feeling, is they're letting it happen. They're not interfering too much because they're sort of expecting those things. They're expecting Don Jr. and Stone to get indicted, maybe, you know, other figures around them. And as long as that's it, they can, you know, let Mueller issue his report and kind of be done with it. And it won't require some larger interference. And that's why Whitaker isn't threatening it. That's why there's not more noise about it. They've sort of assumed that it's not going to stretch much beyond that.
Although, do they have to? I mean, what they have to worry about now that they didn't have to worry about before is that the people who determine what stretches are now in control of the House of Representatives, which is that.
Well, not for the Mueller investigation.
But the Mueller investigation will present its report, and then the House will respond. So, if they indict Don Jr., presumably, if there's something to. Well, one of the things that he may be in trouble for is not telling the truth to investigators in the House. So that's one thing that then mushrooms into a bigger problem. But the key thing about Don Jr. is he's at that June meeting with the Russians, who are at the meeting supposedly coming from the Russian government with dirt on Hillary Clinton. So, you know, will there be proof that Donald Trump knew nothing about that meeting? That would be something you could imagine House investigators looking into. And it's not crazy to ask that question. I guess the point is, if Don Jr. is involved, it's a short trip to the president, and the short trip in political distance is really what we need to think about there is, could Democrats have an investigation that goes beyond Mueller and says, look, this isn't crazy to investigate these questions because Don Jr. was so close to his father.
Isn't it also just a big deal that the son of the president, who was heavily involved in his campaign is getting indicted. I feel like we've skipped over that. That does not seem to me something that the Trump administration can shrug off.
Right. And especially also one of the things is the president is Don Jr.'s response about what he was doing at that meeting, which the president had a hand in crafting that public statement,
which was
what we call not true or known in the business as a lie.
I don't know. It just feels like if there's not that much more than what we the public already know, that's fine. That's a totally adequate result.
It's outrageous.
It's outrageous.
I know
you're
so blasé about this. I'm irritated by all of it. The premise that you can be blasé, and also that there's any reason to think that we know everything. When every time Mueller's issued an indictment, there have been new and juicy facts in it. Mm-hmm.
He's being professionally blasé.
Well, no, that's a very fair point, Emily, which is that the investigation has always been ahead of the reporting, which is as it should be, and thank goodness for that.
And kind of a miracle also, given all the leaking.
I just mean as a matter of politics and a matter of like, will this have consequence? Of course it's consequential for Don Jr. if he goes to prison. And of course it must be frustrating for the president that his son could be indicted and that his buddy Roger Stone could be indicted. But I just don't know as a big political matter. It doesn't feel to me that if that is the nut of what the Mueller investigation comes to is what sort of more or less what we already know, I'm sure with you know, trailing strands and filigrees elsewhere. It doesn't seem to me that will fundamentally change how people, Americans, think about it, doesn't make it likely the president is impeached or removed from office for this.
So is your although there
are
crimin-
although there
Trump
are clearly is, crimes.
Well, so are you saying that unless Trump is indicted or all unless yeah, is your standard unless Trump is indicted and impeached that there are no political ramifications? Because that seems wrong to me, right? Like, first of all, Mueller could write a report in which he lays out all the evidence for obstruction of justice and puts it in Congress's court, right? Second of all, the piling up of indictments, including Don Jr., could matter a lot politically going into 2020, even if Trump remains in office, which I still think he probably will, right? You still have those political ramifications playing out and perhaps a distancing of other elected Republican officials from a president who would appear more and more battered and potentially toxic in 2020.
Just picking up on that last point, I wonder, so what you just described is the way things used to operate in the old world.
No, it's true.
No, I don't mean to suggest that I'm back to those old days. Right. No, and so what you say makes perfect sense, except I'm just have fresh in my memory something that happened this week. And we talked about it last week, the stickiness of partisanship that allows a norm-shifting president to then bring along huge other institutions, whether it's the Senate or the Republican Party. And this week, the president attacked Admiral McRaven, who was the head of special operations, a 37-year veteran of the services, a Navy SEAL, highly respected, led the operations that captured Saddam and killed bin Laden. And the president basically responded to McRaven's claim that the president's attacks on the press were the greatest threat to democracy by saying, well, he's basically a political hack. He's a supporter of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. The Clinton piece was not true. Yes, he worked for Obama, but that...
Different than partisan supporter.
Right. And so just the absolute partisan response from the president as opposed to, say, a previous president who would have demurred and said, well, I respect his service, but I disagree with his opinion. So the Republican Party then starts tweeting out things about McRaven, saying basically like he was on Hillary Clinton's shortlist. So now you have the Republican Party, a party that's traditionally been associated with respecting the military and the people who serve and serve with as much distinction as McRaven did, basically taking the president's line. So you have this shift. So back to what you were saying, Emily, the distance doesn't seem to be created by people. So, you know, Jeff Flake creates distance, but he's on his way out.
Jeff Flake.
Although this week he did say he would hold up judges.
Waiting for the actual judge who doesn't get confirmed because of Jeff Flake's missing vote, and then I will give Jeff Flake some credit. Until then, I don't want to hear about it.
Let me add one other thing, which is we're highly into the realm of the speculative here because Don Jr. hasn't even been indicted, but it does seem, David, that one thing that when this all finally comes out, I mean, we must tally, the existing tally, which is that you have the president's former national security advisor, his campaign chairman, his campaign deputy, that have all been charged. And so his lawyer is charged, you know, his fixer. So any new person, especially if that person, to engage in the speculation again, if that person has the same name with just a little junior at the end, is on top of a pretty big mountain already of people, and that will create responses from the president, which will have political ramifications, because this is obviously something that the president, when he is attacked and any movement against his son would be seen as that, he responds double force. So I think the political ramifications would be the earthquake also created by the president's in response.
Last question on this, Emily. It now seems very clear the president will not sit, at least will not voluntarily sit for an interview with the Mueller team. He told Chris Wallace in an interview on Fox that he wouldn't do it. He is going to answer some of the written questions that were posed to him.
Well, he's not answering them. Well, his lawyers are
going to answer some of the written questions that are posed to him. He had been saying essentially since the investigation started, of course he would sit down for an interview. He wanted to do it. Do you think that there's any possibility that we get a subpoena and a kind of compelled testimony here, number one? And number two, was it a pose all the way along that he wanted to sit for an interview? It always seemed to me insane to think that he could voluntarily sit for an interview given how mendacious he is.
You know, a braggadocio. What's the word? Braggart? He's also a braggart.
Who practices braggadocio.
Yeah, who practices braggadocio, precisely. And I have no idea whether he really believed he would sit for the interview or was just bluffing. I agree with you that his lawyers would, you know, have lain their bodies down to make sure that he did not do so. I sort of think that subpoenaing the president to sit for an interview is not the hill that Mueller is going to die on, because I'm not sure how important it is. I mean, obviously, if you're a prosecutor, you want to ask these questions. You are trying to figure out a charge of obstruction of justice in particular, which depends on mindset. And so when you have all these facts you can line up to try to catch someone, you want to ask those questions directly. I also think that if Trump's lawyers don't answer some written questions, Mueller can infer from that that, you know, they don't want to answer them. And unless Trump pleads the fifth, those inferences could be part of an indictment. You could imagine that. I think, though, as I said, that look, I mean, there are already lots of reasons to think that Mueller won't actually indict Trump because of the Justice Department memos that suggest he doesn't have that authority. When he's writing this report, presumably for Congress to consider impeachment, he can explain the answers that Trump did and didn't give, and Congress can make a, you know, decision either way. And then I guess there's also this sort of question down the road after Trump is out of office, what kind of legal exposure he would have.
I know, Emily, that you're right. Like, it's an outrage. It's a terrible, the whole.
But you're over it.
No, it's not that I'm over it. I don't know.
But
I
don't
mean, yes,
fall
I'm over.
Into the trap of like it's just everything is meaningless. Like, I know it feels that way, but we don't have to like.
No,
we
it's,
don't
it's
have
an
to
outrage.
Give up.
It's an outrage. There's so many outrages. It's just this outrage that this outrage has taken a disproportionate amount of people's mental energy and time compared to what it can actually accomplish. Whereas I think the policy stuff is much more important. I think I think his personal corruption, the corruption within the administration is more important in a way than this story.
Right,
the corruption really speaks to people. It gets people really irritated when you learn that somebody is wasting money on some bullshit.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think if you are a liberal who wants the Mueller investigation to be the magic bullet that is going to slay Donald Trump in 1 second and make him go poof, then you're probably going to be disappointed. Trump has done a masterful job at making it seem partisan and complicated and like a witch hunt, as he keeps saying, even though Mueller is like the least partisan person walking around in the country. So, you know, all of those things are true. It has also been true that every time Mueller has actually acted, it's been highly professional and reassuring in its professionalism. So it will be, you know, the best that a highly trained and skillful American prosecutor has to offer.
So Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. Today's bonus segment, we're going to talk about whether Thanksgiving is a liberal or a conservative holiday, or neither, perhaps. Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. The campfire continues to burn in Northern California, while the Woolsey Fire is more contained in Southern California. Together, the two fires have burned more than 250,000 acres. That's, I think, about six entire Washington, D.C.'s, if my math is right. The town of Paradise, really the small city of Paradise, has been destroyed. More than 70 people are dead. About 1,000 people are on a missing persons list just for the campfire. The damage is going to be in the tens of billions of dollars, and it's going to continue to cause people to suffer. The smoke, for example, dangerous smoke, has been choking lots of California, including the Bay Area. There will be more fires. The hot and dry conditions will continue. It is a terrible, dangerous, awful situation, and it has a kind of relentlessness. An earthquake is a single episode, a single incident, which causes tremendous damage. The thing about these fires is they come again, and they takes them a long time to get controlled, and they are controlled, and then they reappear. It's they're relentless in this way that's quite awful. So, Emily, start with you. Why is it that there is so much more fire now than there was? Is there so much more fire in California in particular than there was?
There is more fire, or at least the biggest fires that are doing the most damage are recent fires almost entirely. There are a few factors. There is climate change, which is raising the temperature just enough to make all this flammable material more burnable, combustible. There are old standing fire suppression tactics where all of this material has not been allowed to burn in the past, and so there is more of it. And then there's people and where they live, and the fact that there were 27,000 people in Paradise, which Paradise, California, that is. And they were there, you know, kind of heartbreakingly, because housing is so expensive in California that this was like a haven for them, but the price they were paying was to be in the path of this fire. And so, you know, the one thing that strikes me about these fires, which is also true of hurricanes and other extreme weather events, is the stories are like Armageddon, right? I mean, we see these cars, we see these people, we hear these like terrifying audios of people who literally are in fear that they will be burned to a crisp. And it's like we're returning to some past in which we couldn't count on safety and security, and the predictability of American, at least middle class life, can no longer be taken for granted. And there's just something so, I don't know what the word is, like willfully crazy about not addressing particularly climate change, and thus putting some members of our society at risk of these terrifying events that in most of the rest of everything we do, we try so hard to prevent. I mean, it reminds me also of gun violence in its way, where like the most important thing is keeping children safe, except like, oh no, we have all these firearms that hurt people. And that's like this exposure, that this risk, this vulnerability that we're willing to countenance. And the way we make our peace with it is we just assume it will never be us like driving our car with our kids while these like telephone wires and logs are burning and crashing down around us. But when you have to really think about it, it's totally bizarre and terrifying.
Well, just one point there, Emily, which is, I agree with you 98% with what you said. And I certainly the feelings that you express there are ones that I share. But I would say that this period where life as a citizen, life as a human being was pretty safe and secure, and you didn't have to worry about natural disaster or disease or whatever, it's been a pretty brief period.
Like, yeah,
the secure middle class, backstopped by society period. And even in a rich country like America, it's been It's been sort of 50 years.
And it's never applied to everyone, too. You're right, but I don't think that we expected it to end. I mean, it's our lifetimes, right?
Exactly.
Like, well, I take it for granted.
Also, the speeding up of history, so let's say it's been 50 years, the speeding up of history makes it feel, it feels to me, makes it feel like it was longer in the past. So, you know, all of the devices, when I was talking to the director of the CDC, he said, you know, if there's another pandemic, it will strip us down to primitive life because all of the comforts and devices and things we have that are the structure of modernity all go away and they're all useless against this thing. And so you're back to the age where you're knocking rocks against each other to make
and which many of us are not going to fare well.
Right.
I'm not going to fare well when we are knocking rocks against each other. And
exactly.
I don't know where anything
well,
is.
Well, but this is what's I mean, I wish we were talking about the Michael Lewis book, the Fifth Risk book.
We can talk about the Fifth Risk.
Well, we haven't, but we all have. I wish we were doing it systematically. Maybe we'll do it systematically one day. But one of the points he makes is that sort of the great value of government is not necessarily visible every day. It's sort of risks avoided. It's things put off because you maintain the highways. Because you invest in education, so your population is smarter. You have you maintain adequate supplies of that vaccine,
right?
And that is what's alarming.
And that there are all these career professionals whose whole job is to protect you and stave off those dangers, and they are being properly husbanded as a resource, right, by the federal government, and taking them for granted, and that whole apparatus and mission for granted is such an enormous mistake.
One thing I would add to the list that Emily gave was the Santa Ana winds, which are part of what create the devastation here. At one point, the winds were blowing so hard that the fire was not actually burning the trees. It was blowing sideways. And so the fire was burning the cars and the homes, and the trees around were surviving. Just to the point about severity, since records were kept in 1932, the 10 largest fires have been since 2000, 5 since 2010, and 2 of the largest fires in California history happened this year alone.
Right.
So that just to the climate point, I think we're up 2 or 3 degrees in California. Then I don't know what the baseline for that is, but it's 2 to 3 degrees more in temperature.
Can we talk about affordable housing in California? Because, you know, there was and could still be a proposal to relax zoning rules so that more affordable housing can be built along transportation networks, like in San Francisco region, BART, which is, you know, the metro effectively. And you could imagine parts of California where you build more densely, you allow people to move into the cities by taking advantage of these transportation hubs, and the people who can only afford to live like up on a hill where it's dangerous get to come down from the hill and down from the fire danger. If Gavin Newsom, the new governor of California, is really serious about helping California and making it a better place to live, this would be a huge thing that he could do to address inequality, which is an enormous problem in California.
Yeah, you know what is crazy about this is climate change is not a problem that the governor of California can fix on his own. Rising heat is not a problem that the governor of California can fix or the legislature of California can fix or the legislature of the United States even can fix. But there are this is a problem which policy can have such an impact on. And there was a great article, and I'm sorry I didn't know who wrote it, about comparing the fire response to what the Dutch have done around sea level rise and the Dutch have done around just the fact that it's a low-lying country in a time when the storms are worse and the sea is rising. And the Dutch government, I mean, it's an existential threat to the Netherlands. And there has been this huge investment in amelioration and ways to just spend some money to make it safer. You know that there's going to be damage, but let's make it safer. Let's, you know, avoid losing as much property as we can. Let's avoid losing life. And let's make those upfront investments. And you have really smart people doing it. And in the case of fire in California, there are so many policy measures that can be taken, which aren't even partisan, that could be taken that would make a difference. I mean, and housing is a great one, Emily. I mean, that is a key one. But urban density is one cure for this, not because it would cause not fires not to happen. It would just mean that people weren't being affected as badly by these fires, and they weren't losing property in the way they're losing property. But also the policies about removing flammable materials from around homes, like requiring people to use less flammable materials in home construction, removal of brush and dead trees. There's all sorts of things which are a matter of state, local policy that can make a huge difference. And so people should freaking do it. It's just crazy not to. But there's this resistance to government action, which has pervaded American life and to regulation. And it's just causing us to do stupid things. And it's frustrating.
These moments of crisis where the whole nation turns its head to watch the horrible effects of the are a moment where a president, who is the one, to the extent we have a national voice, can tee up what you're talking about, David, which is the world has convened, or at least the United States has convened in this moment. And so a policy response, or at least convening people to come up with a policy response, is one of the powers a president has. And that's why, you know, the president talking about raking in Finland was obviously off the mark by what he actually said. But also the response to it was nuts. I mean, people just made fun of him, and the press like fact checked whether they use rakes in Finland. And the moment wasn't used to talk about what you're talking about, to talk about obviously what the actual difference is in Finland, which is it's a lot colder and wetter there than in California. And that's why it was an absurd analogy, not whether they actually use rakes or not, which was the subject of some of the fact checks, whether they actually use rakes or not, which suggests to me that the fact checkers had totally missed the entire point. And it's, you know, they can make fun of the president, but when the people doing the fact checking miss the point of why the analogy breaks down, and by missing the point, miss an opportunity to educate people about actually what happened, then that's us failing.
In Finland, there's this tremendous private-public partnership around this, so that pilots, all the people who fly, like are taught to
first
be on the lookout, the lookout for fires, so they catch fires much earlier.
I was thinking about this morning. Part of me appreciates the moments of humor that come out of Trump's more ridiculous statements. Like suddenly there's a meme of a rake and a fire and everyone's like taking a break. But there's also something like deadeningly nihilistic about it, right? It's like you're not thinking about all the actual policy matters or choices you were just talking about, right? You're not using it as an opportunity to educate. You're just like mocking in this way that doesn't really teach anyone anything. And it becomes this total, as usual, like long cul-de-sac of distraction where like that's what gets attention because it's really easy to glom onto. I don't know what to do about that. Complaining about it makes me feel humorless and like miserly.
Do you all think, I mean, who the hell knows, but There are 1,000 people on this list, and Clara Jeffrey, our colleague, the editor of Mother Jones, former colleague of mine, beloved colleague of mine, noted that if there are 1,000 people missing in the East Coast, every minute of the day would be focused on this issue. The fact that it's out in the West and that it's more a kind of remote community has made people blasé about it. Do you think there's anything to that? And also, do you think it's also that people think, oh, there aren't really 1,000 people who are going to die in this fire? That's just somebody's misinterpreted something.
Well, the coverage of it has been a little uneven. I mean, I must say, CBS, we got a lot of people out there. But I think there's probably something to what she's saying. I mean, there's undoubtedly something to what she's saying. The East Coast versus West Coast media focus issue is pretty well established. But I think there, based on what I've read, there is 1,000 people doesn't mean 1,000. There are a lot of people, based on the reporting I've read, I haven't done any actual reporting myself, but that there are people who are on the list who don't even know they're on the list. And that it's, according to one official I read, who said basically they put anybody who calls 911 and says, I can't find Joe or Uncle Sam gets put on the list. Right. I'm now speaking metaphorically. Uncle Sam gets put on the list.
Uncle Sam is on the list.
Yeah.
He is kind of MIA.
Uncle Sam gets put on the list. And then Uncle Sam doesn't know he's on the list, and he doesn't go check the list. And so he remains on the list. And once I found Uncle Sam, I don't call back up and say, hey, take him off the list.
The list is created to be over-inclusive, and I think that's part of what's going on. We don't actually think there are 1,000 people who are missing.
But there will be.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who are missing and dead, and that is horrible. I mean, yeah, I'm sure John and Clara are right about West versus East Coast. I think there's also just this period of drip unknown information that confuses the media about how seriously to treat it.
Just one small story, which actually has really nothing to do with the fires themselves, that I found so outrageous. There have been stories which are supposed to be heartwarming about California prison inmates fighting these fires and being paid $1 a day to do it. And of course, I thank them for their service, and I'm sure they're doing great work, and it's dangerous and risky. But there was this outrageous story about the fact that if you are a California prisoner, you come out of prison and you've had this experience fighting fires, you can't actually get a job as a firefighter, because most firefighters in California have to be trained as EMTs. And if you have a prison record, it's very hard to get – you're basically barred from getting an EMT license as a former felon. And so then you can't become a firefighter. So even though you have this useful skill that you have learned serving the public, you're then barred. What a waste of human capacity. What a waste of goodwill. It's really infuriating.
There's a great magazine piece in my very own New York Times magazine about exactly this issue by Jamie Lowe. It's called The Incarcerated Women Who Fight California's Wildfires. And it's about them as human beings and, you know, what it would take, which is not very much, to change this whole picture so that, you know, inmates are being trained for something. Women who are in prison are being trained for something that then they have as a marketable skill when they get out.
I did not read that story, but as part of it, the unseemly power of these public employee unions, particularly firefighter and police unions, which are just grotesquely powerful and even more so in California than in other places.
I don't remember.
Which is a bar. I mean, they serve as this bar. It's this professional bar. I mean, it's the whole way in which credentialing just prevents people from entering professions. Now, there are really good reasons. Obviously, you can imagine there are kinds of people who should not be allowed to get a firefighter license. If you are an arsonist, you know.
Okay, but that is a very small number of people. Let's be very clear, right?
Right. Yeah.
One other angle to this, which is interesting to me, just because I'm interested and only and not that knowledgeable about, but the way in which private industry has to make decisions and claims based on climate change science in a way that if governments aren't acting, private industry has to. So PG&E is being sued by 400 or more people who say basically they should have shut the power off when the conditions got to this tinderbox level, and they said, well, the conditions didn't meet our normal standards. Well, they're facing liability for this destruction. And I wonder how that will – it's hammered their stock, which is down like almost half.
Yeah, because they may not be able to cover the gap.
Right, the insurance won't be able to cover the gap. So what in the future will any company that worries about liability in California for potentially starting or contributing to the start of a fire – how they have to calculate that into their business model, particularly PG&E.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any knowledge about PG&E, and I'm no doubt they're voracious and rapacious and terrible in all kinds of ways. But it does seem pretty unfair. I mean, these are conditions that are beyond the control of PG&E, and PG&E's obligation as the public utility in that area is to provide people with power and to provide businesses with power. And it's a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Now, and it's one of these situations where, from what I've seen, is that PG&E's lines and are causing fires at this that never happened a generation ago. It's not that they suddenly their equipment is shoddy. It's just that the conditions are terrible. And you know, they can't on their own bury all the power lines in California. It costs a prohibitively huge amount of money. And so it does seem unfair to make them the liable party here.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Facebook, worse than even we ever thought. We've been Facebook skeptics here at GabFest Central. At least Emily and I have been Facebook skeptics. I'm not sure of John's policy on Facebook for a while. And the last few weeks have brought a series of stories that highlight just how vastly its self-presentation differs from its actuality. There have been a number of bad stories in the past few years, obviously. The evidence that Russian trolls pervaded Facebook throughout the 2016 campaign. The shame of Cambridge Analytica and the way that Facebook allowed it to take all kinds of data that shouldn't have been public and or shouldn't have been shared with it and use that to possibly manipulate campaigns. Now comes a damning New York Times investigation by some of Emily's colleagues that shows that the company, upon learning about the Russian manipulation, upon learning about the kind of ways in which Facebook was being put to use in the election campaign, that the company behaved in really poor ways. What did your colleagues at the Times find, Emily, and why was it so depressing?
Well, confronted with information from Alex Stamos and his team, Stamos was like the head of security of Facebook at the time, and he had basically on his own taken a team to really investigate the Russian interference in postings because nobody else was doing it and seemed to want to know. And also at Facebook, after Mark Zuckerberg said following the election that he thought it was crazy to imagine that these political posts on his own site could have affected the election, people at Facebook were like, wait a second, this was happening. And so they set out to prove it. And at a moment when the Facebook board was being briefed and got upset and said, wait a second, why didn't you tell us about this earlier? This is a huge deal. We need to address it. It seems that Sheryl Sandberg yelled at Alex Stamos and got angry about having been blindsided, supposedly, as opposed to hearing this information and taking in the substance of it and saying, oh my God, this company is a force for destruction in a way that Zuckerberg and I didn't understand. And now we're going to go and deal with it. And the thing about this report is it's both incredibly revealing and yet in its own way, not surprising. Like if you are the people at the head of that company, you have an enormous amount invested in seeing it as a force of good in the world. We've seen so many indications from Zuckerberg and Sandberg that they just have drunk that Kool-Aid. And it's a larger Silicon Valley phenomenon, right? They're like particularly noticeable and important in their manifestation of it. But my experience of reporting in Silicon Valley is lots of people are drinking that Kool-Aid. So then when it turns out not to be true, it's like fundamentally undermining to one's whole identity to imagine that actually this institution, this company was doing bad things all along and you didn't recognize it and you didn't stop it and you kind of didn't care about it or signal to anyone that was of importance. And so I think that this Times story shows Sandberg and Zuckerberg continuing in that line and doing some nefarious things. I mean, hiring this like, you know, kind of secretive political opposition ad firm or whatever, public relations firm to start seeding fake posts and like blaming George Soros. I mean, to have these two Jewish corporate leaders out there like adding to the anti-Semitic attacks that use George Soros as like its pinata, that really made me and I think a lot of other people kind of nauseous. And so we're just seeing this internal picture of a corporation that is enormously powerful and is not responsible in its use of power.
One of the things that's always been a disconnect is between the public outrage about Facebook and their responses, which have always seemed to kind of miss what people need. So, you know, in any of these instances where somebody's apology just doesn't meet the moment, theirs have always felt just insufficient. And so when the Times piece came out, the idea that they were behind the scenes going on the offense to try to create, and the reason, as I understand it, the kind of connection to George Soros was a part of the strategy was to basically, and it's not unlike what some politicians do, which is to discredit the criticism as having been ginned up. So in other words, this big thing everybody's making a big concern about, it's really ginned up, and so don't be so concerned about it, which affirms the underlying skepticism people may have had that they didn't take the criticism seriously in the first place. And then now in the response to the New York Times story, Sheryl Sandberg in her in an interview she did with Norm O'Donnell was basically said, I had zero to do with any of this.
Which is so implausible. And if it were true, it would be upsetting because that was her job.
Right. There you go.
The contrast between their self-presentation, the hacker utopian self-presentation, and the dingy, trite reality of how they behave is so extraordinary. I mean, you don't expect ExxonMobil to have utopian hoo-ha coming out of their pie hole. They're a big, gigantic company, and they're going to protect their interests. You're not surprised if you learn that ExxonMobil or company X is using a crisis PR company to discredit its opponents. Okay, that's a standard tactic. It is that contrast that's so galling, and the hypocrisy of it is so maddening. I mean, they hired Schumer's daughter. That's another one that I love. They hired Chuck Schumer's daughter to spin for them. Sandberg personally worked over Amy Klobuchar, using some of her lean-in credibility.
And got her to go kind of quiet, at least in her Facebook posts, right?
And John, your point about their apologies is such a good one. They're always apologizing for stuff, and it's always, A, it's just not, it's words without meaning, so they're, and nothing seems to change afterwards. There's this amazing little Vice episode where Vice posed, so they have a functionality on Facebook where you can buy ads brought to you, sponsored by, or like, I'm trying to remember the term. It's basically so you would identify the ad as coming from legitimate source. And so Vice posed as every single senator. They just pretended to be all the senators and bought a bunch of ads pretending to be that senator. Facebook didn't check. They didn't see if it was actually the senator. They didn't care. They just let, so you could go and buy an ad pretending to be Lindsey Graham and make any wild accusation you want to make or make any claim you want to make, and it would
probably all
Facebook
automated.
would let it through. No, Facebook said, they said, oh, this didn't meet our standards. We made a mistake.
They're always making a mistake.
They're always making a mistake.
Standards and then not doing anything about it.
Yeah. Sorry, well, I just to get this point out, and then I'll shut up. Is Kevin Roos, the journalist, is between doing God's work where he's been tracking what are the most popular Facebook posts on particular subjects. And what he has shown consistently is, so Facebook has made such a big deal about how we're going to get, more honorable sources, more credible sources. We're going to make sure that the fake news isn't circulating. And Roos points out that on any given story, if you look, 6, 8, 9 of the top 10 stories are going to be extremely right-wing, often conspiratorial. Sometimes it's just right-wing media spin on something, but it's often conspiratorial spin on it. So for all that they've talked about, we're cleaning up the platform, actually the stuff that continues to be most popular, that they continue to circulate most broadly, is the crap. And there's a wonderful Washington Post story by Eli Saslow, the brilliant reporter, about a site called, what is it called? A Facebook site called America's Last Line of Defense, which is literally a liberal parody site set up by a guy just to troll right-wingers. And he would make up stories that would be like, Hillary Clinton dies in secret overseas mission to smuggle more refugees into America. And he would write these fake stories. And they're hugely popular because conservative paranoia.
Yeah, it didn't recognize the parody, huh?
Yeah, don't recognize the parody and circulate it widely. And it just propagates these lies. And has Facebook cracked down on it? Has Facebook said this stuff is illegit or this is having a baleful effect? No, they don't give a shit. They don't care.
Well, I just wonder whether marketers at some point will start to say, no, we don't want to be associated with that world, or whether they are just too gargantuan for marketers to leave, and whether anybody could create a social networking platform that lacked some of the either public relations problems that Facebook has faced, or that just in general solves for the vinegariness of social media. I don't know if that's even possible, but it seems like that opportunity is becoming more and more happening. One other thing about
Instagram, I actually think has some of that role. Instagram is a much sweeter platform.
Yes,
Instagram lacks it.
Owned by Facebook,
and Facebook's done a great job of protecting it. And
although,
I don't know, the founders of Instagram left.
But one other thing about the apologies is that often I felt like the responses that were couched as apologies were actually just marketing statements. So they would say, we're really taking we're really focusing on security and the focus on pace and growing our user base that maybe caused us to overlook some of these security problems before. We're not doing that. We're focusing now on user engagement, which felt like a marketing pitch. Like they have their moment that everybody's focusing on them. They know they got to make an apology, but then they like tack on, like, here's the fun part of Facebook we're focusing on now. So keep being involved. And that seemed to me to kind of undermine the authenticity of some of those apologies as well.
I was really struck by something my colleague Nick Confessori said, which is that, you know, a century ago, Upton Sinclair exposed this, like, totally horrifying nature of, you know, meat marketing and
in the jungle
in his like famous muckraking book about American factories and food production. And before that, we thought of these as, I guess I wasn't there, but like these were assumed to be kind of virtuous or at least neutral, morally neutral companies. And Facebook is having that kind of moment. And we're all having a moment of realizing that social media, which presented itself as this, you know, Silicon Valley, like making the world better, that's not true. It's not. And what happened after the jungle was that the food industry got regulated. And that is what Facebook is desperately trying to stave off and what is enormously needed right now. So when I read that Facebook is talking about creating some independent, quote, you know, court that is going to be deciding what can be posted and not, it does not reassure me. It is time for the government to come in and set some limits and think about also whether this company needs to have some antitrust changes made to it also. I mean, maybe Facebook should not own Instagram and WhatsApp and Snapchat and, yeah, yuck.
So I don't know if this is where you were. We were about to say, David, about the jungle, but my favorite line from that was,
I know you're about to say.
Yes, I wrote a book to hit people in the heart and I hit him in the stomach because he was trying to raise awareness about Jurgis, who works, I think that was his name, who worked in, you know, these awful conditions, and people didn't care so much about him. They cared about the food that was coming to them and whether it was healthy. But this leads to another question I have about Facebook from a business standpoint, which is, you know, what do people want from social media? And has the underlying, when this all first started happening, I thought, yeah, people don't like whatever bad things are happening to Facebook, but ultimately, like, they want to connect and they want to be, you know, I want to check out what's happening with my nephews
and
how
they want to post stuff and have their voices heard, right? Which we should all sympathize with because we're journalists.
Right,
we have
exactly.
That
so I kind of thought that pull would continue, that people would say, yeah, I don't like this stuff over here, but gosh, I really enjoy being able to like see pictures of McLean, Virginia in the 1970s when I grew up, and there's really no other place I can go to for that. So I wonder from a user standpoint, I know a lot of people say like, I'm never going on back on Facebook, but I feel like my Facebook feed is still pretty well populated with all of that stuff and that people are still using it.
You know what to me is weird though, John? Well, yes, I think that a lot of people still do use it, and especially people who are older. I don't know if you guys remember.
That's why it's important that they own these other services where the youth are.
Yes, the youth. That
about 10 years ago or more when I was editor of Slate, I assigned Emily Yaffe to write a story which was called, I think the headline was Facebook and 50-something, where she was then 50 or 51 or something and went on Facebook. And the idea was, oh my God, it's so funny. How funny would it be to be an old person on Facebook? And now, of course, Facebook has become a platform for old people. But I do think that it is really – I mean, people tend to lump all these services together. They tend to say, you know, put them all, oh, it's the social media has this detrimental effect, and oh, Twitter, oh, Google – Facebook, Instagram, but it really is so much worse with Facebook. Twitter, there's lots of problems with Twitter, and I can absolutely see why people wouldn't want to be on it. But sorry, I just banged. I was so excited, I just banged a chair. Forgive that noise. But at the same time, like, Twitter is more or less does what you expect it to do. It is always, I've always understood it. It behaves in the way that it.
Twitter's indefensible. I don't know what you're talking about. Twitter does a terrible job of monitoring its content. It doesn't have, you know, real name requirements, which makes it like a total trash heap. It may behave as you expect it to, and you have a thick skin, but I don't think that we can argue that Twitter is any better. It's smaller. Right. It has that going.
Maybe maybe it's all that it's smaller.
And for journalists, it's catnip because we're all on there like gossiping and watching each other. But I don't think it's like a better site for a lot of people.
I don't think it does the kind of pervasive damage that Facebook does. I don't think Google does. I don't think Instagram does. WhatsApp, I don't know enough about.
WhatsApp is ruining elections in other countries, like including in Brazil, by having these like mass group chats that spread totally false and like inciting to violence information.
So your view is that all social media are bad?
No, I don't. I feel some hope about Instagram. I think there's something about the more visual nature of it that seems to make it like, I don't know, a little nicer.
It'll be ruined soon enough.
It does seem like there is a way in which these things go toward the lowest common denominator. I don't know. I'd like to think otherwise. I'm all for connecting.
As an antisocial person, am not all for connecting, and basically would tell all of you that this was predictable years ago.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So say more about that. Because what? You feel like you don't want to be bombarded by...
Well, no, it's not true. Because that was a stupid detour. I guess what I was wondering is whether this is a solvable problem for Facebook. So they can apologize and hire billions of people to monitor this and that and the other thing. But it seems to me that the only solution to restoring what it once was is to find, and I know they're searching madly for this, some new great reason for everybody to want to be on it and generate a good feeling about being on it. Because are you really going to get credit if you stop all the bad stuff from happening? People, you know, maybe there won't be so many stories that you hear in the news, and maybe 10 years down the road, people will say, oh, they had that rough patch, but now, you know, they've sort of survived. But to regain its place that it once had, it seems to me it's got two problems. It's got to kind of put out this solve this problem, and then the other big problem is how do you create meaningful engagement in a world of so many competitors with interesting and fascinating content. That's a super hard thing to do.
But solving the problem is doable. I mean, it would take money and it would take a willingness to censor and regulate speech. Absolutely. But those things are attainable. Like, you don't have to have the Kevin Roos list of, you know, wildly circulating conspiracy theory posts every week. That is not a necessary feature.
I guess what I feel like is this is like when we installed new windows in our house. We spent all this money installing the new windows in our house, and you basically can't. The house looks exactly the same, right? I mean, it helps on the energy bills a little bit, but it's basically fixing these problems are just a massive, massive sunk cost for which they will get some credit, but which they will not overcome the deficit they're in as a result of all these problems and the odor that is now attached to Facebook.
Well,
I mean, that's not a disagreement with what you're saying. I just think that's their
condition. Right?
Totally. Like, totally. No. I'm just saying, like, the
yes, I hear you.
I guess I'm just trying to line up all the problems they face and see whether, you know, what situation they're in.
Although, when you were talking before about advertisers and, you know, whether people are going to start to walk away, solving the problems could do a lot to reassure advertisers. So in terms of
that's the bottom line, that does matter a lot. That's an excellent point.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Let's go to cocktail chatter when you're preparing for Thanksgiving with a really, really stiff mulled wine, if there can be such a thing as a stiff mulled wine. Or in my house, it's usually a sherry, and you're having a sherry. What will you be chattering about, Emily the Baz?
I am writing a piece right now about the census, and maybe we will actually make the census into a whole topic in the coming weeks.
Absolutely.
I'm so excited to talk about this.
Count me in.
Count John in. Thank you. Just as a preliminary matter, I went to the trial in Manhattan that was taking place last week about the census. And what I came away with, so this was mostly a super boring day that I spent because it was this very technical testimony about statistics and how the census is put together and like the word coefficient and other terms that I like barely remember from math and probably never fully understood anyway. And yet I came away David is pretending to go to sleep right now. No. I came away feeling so...
I was just stretching. I was enjoying your riff.
I came away feeling so reassured and kind of perversely moved by the dedication of our federal bureaucracy. Like, here are these teams of people doing these super important tasks that nobody appreciates. Like, the census is one of those things that, you know, we take for granted. We think of it as just a form to fill out. Actually, it's like a super important underpinning of our democracy, which is under threat. And these folks who, you know, have dedicated their careers to making this huge apparatus of federal government functional, are explaining all the work they do. And there was just this something about it that, you know, I came away thinking like, wow, this is an amazing feat. And I don't know if I'm going to succeed in conveying that as a writer, but like, I really need to try. Anyway, so let's talk more about the census. But in the meantime, let's give thanks for the census on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, no, that's very good. That's very good.
John.
I like that.
What is your chatter?
My chatter is totally frivolous. Snoop Dogg, you may be familiar with his work.
Wait, who's he?
Is
Calvin Brodus.
JK.
We all think about him during the Thanksgiving season, but more to the point, recently he got a Hollywood star on the Walk of Fame, and I'd just like to read you a passage from his remarks at the. The laying of the star, the unveiling of the star. He said, I want to thank me for believing in me. I want to thank me for doing all this hard work. I want to thank me for having no days off. I want to thank me for never quitting. I want to thank me for always being a giver and trying to give more than I receive. I want to thank me for trying to do more right than wrong. I want to thank me for just being me at all times. I don't know why that tickled me, but it did. And you should watch the video of it because it's funny.
It is true that you don't get a day off from yourself. That is definitely one of the problems with life.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have a day off, a weekend from yourself.
Right.
That well, is you, so true. It, oh, my God. Think that's more why, than a weekend. I want like a long vacation for myself.
So don't you think that's why people engage in... either go to Renaissance fairs and dress up like elves and wizards or engage in all kinds of other behaviors that literally allow them to try to escape from themselves by creating
different... Yeah, and why do people drink?
How about
that's
like
why they use drugs.
Movies and reading books?
But yeah. I don't know that drinking... Really?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, the just escaping into a book is great. I mean, I find that I have a... My escape velocity from a book is much easier than it used to be. You know, I find that unless a book really grabs me, I'm
that is a depressing feature of our modern world. And yet it is so crucial to embody some like interesting fictional narrator.
Oh my God. Right? Or you become just a howling void. But so I guess my question is whether in our current moment, whether people are... It's not just drinking. You've got to have a more immersive experience and whether people seek that out more because people want an escape from themselves. I don't know. How would you quantify that? I don't know.
I don't know.
The Atlantic writes that nobody's having sex anymore, so they're not doing it that
reason. Was about kids. That was not about us. That
I thought it was about adults, too.
Oh.
Yeah, I thought it was...
There was less sex for adults, but it was more a kind of generational piece, wasn't it? It was about 20-somethings.
Yeah, but but that's sort of weirdly about an epidemic of loneliness where, in fact, people are unable to escape themselves because they are alone.
Right.
I felt on the safe side of the generational dividing line as I read that piece. Well, I felt worried about my children, but I was like, okay, well, this
Emily,
is
I think this is
something
also,
about the 80s.
I would also say that this is something you know or you don't know.
Yeah,
it's like,
right,
I don't think it's not a group solution.
And now we're at the moment of TMI.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
We're retreating
I think you've made a family admission you may or may not have wanted to make.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
I'll take us. I'm going to take us back to safety with my chatter, which is about Michael Bloomberg, which is the least.
Oh God!
Except, who?
Look,
except for me, it's the least sexual. It's the least sexual chatter.
No, but he's your male crush, so look, it's actually perfect.
You can either think about baseball or Michael Bloomberg.
close your eyes and think of Michael Bloomberg.
You're the only one in America.
It's
your personal write-in candidate for life.
We all have our own special turn-ons, Emily. Don't shit on mine.
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead. Tell us more.
It begins.
He just gave a shitload of money to Johns Hopkins. Yes.
As it always does with Michael Bloomberg in pajamas. No, Michael Bloomberg just donated $1.8 billion to Johns Hopkins to guarantee need-blind admissions there. It's the largest university donation ever made, apparently, which is great. That's fine. You know I'm a big Michael Bloomberg fan. No, there's no surprises there. But it did put into focus for me just how pointless and terrible everything is. That this is a classic example of something where there's a billionaire who's putting a Band-Aid on something for one college that he happens to love.
And what if he had to pay $1.8 billion in taxes? And
yes.
Then that money was distributed to low-income people who want to go to lots of colleges and maybe can't get into Johns.
Would you like
Johns
to do my chatter? Would
no,
you like my chatter?
But I had the exact same thought about it last night.
Yeah. It's outrageous that what we're doing is counting on rich people to sort of decide, oh, well, out of the goodness of my heart, I'm going to help out a rich, already rich college that I want to help out rather than, as
that
Emily
I went to.
Just said.
Can I ask then what, and maybe we should find some way to think about this more systematically, but because you could imagine a situation in which giving $1.8 billion to the federal government might not be the most efficient use of that money. So could you create a system whereby, let's say I have $1 billion and you all visit me on my island, and we want to do with that $1 billion the most efficient and useful thing, let's say just in the education area.
Like, surely it would go to community colleges or to public universities, right? Or that you would cost out how to have the most impact on need-blind admissions at private universities.
And could you convene people who could figure out what
Definitely.
To do with the money?
That's
an interesting problem. And I think that is basically what the Gates Foundation has done, to their credit. I think the Gates Foundation is doing that on a global scale. So they looked at what are the problems, malaria being a great example, which caused the most suffering and lost productivity and lost life and lost pleasure. Right. And malaria is one. And so let's try to tackle that. So huzzah to them. But that doesn't go to Emily's point. Of course, the government is going to be less efficient. But there's something deeply wrong with a world in which all the wealth is accumulating to a few people who get to make that decision.
Sure.
Like it actually... And government is not that inefficient. There are certain things that government does much better than anybody else because they are the only ones who can apply that much scale. They're the only ones who can build those highways.
I hijacked your point. I was sorry. I was trying to go off and ask a separate question, which I'm sorry because it kind of stepped on your point.
I think those are both valid and interesting thoughts, right? If you had $1 billion and you had a priority, which was not the military, so you didn't want half your tax dollars to go to the military or whatever the giant percentages, and you had a problem you wanted to solve, like access to college education for low-income people, which is a huge issue. What would you do?
How would you best distribute it?
And I am all for that. I think it's hugely important, but I'm pretty sure that giving all of it to Johns Hopkins is not the most efficient manner.
That's right. No, I'm not. And I wouldn't suggest that. I guess I was just wondering is if you could imagine, I don't know, are there a lot of billionaires like Michael Bloomberg who would think giving it away. Oh, by the way, you also want to create a system where you get the credit for it, right? You don't get credit for paying your taxes so much. So could you create a situation where for the billionaires out there who want to do good, that and maybe the Gates Foundation is basically it, how easy would it be to find a way to most effectively channel that money?
Maybe you have Michael Bloomberg scholarships all over the country at different schools, as opposed to like every building at Johns Hopkins is named after Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah. Why not just call it Johns Bloomberg or Johns Hopkins Bloomberg?
Bloomberg University. It'll be Bloomberg University by the time we're done, I bet. Maybe after his death.
Can they finally put the apostrophe in the Johns Hopkins, by the way?
Just now they
got
John.
All this apostrophe.
I'm kidding.
You're just kidding. But don't you feel like it's one of those terms that you're so proud of yourself when you say correctly?
Like attorneys general.
You're like, I'm an educated person. I wrote attorneys general wrong the other day. Yeah. And then I was slightly mortified, but then thought, this is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay. 1.7 of the 1.8 is going to teach people how to use data correctly in the plural.
We also have a listener chatter this week because you guys continue to tweet great chatters to us at Slate Gabfest and email us at gabfest@slate.com with your excellent ideas for cocktail chatter. And this week's chatter comes from Jonathan Bode at jbode, B-A-U-D-E. An article in Thrillist by Kevin Alexander, which is headlined, "I found the best burger place in America and then I killed it." And it's a story about a food critic who named a burger at a gritty joint in Portland the best burger in America. And this restaurant then was overwhelmed and just went downhill and became miserable to work there, became miserable to go there. The staff became unpleasant to people. There's actually some ambiguity about whether the Alexander article was in fact the responsible agent here, that the restaurant may have actually had problems which were totally independent of being named the best burger in America. But it's a really interesting piece about the quest for authenticity, authentic experience, and how much people in the Instagram age, how much people want to make a checkbox, make a bucket list of, oh, I ate the best burger in America, and the complexities of that. So check out the story in Thrillist, "I found the best burger in America." That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank, who is visiting in Washington, D.C. today, which is so exciting for me. Jocelyn has grown 4 inches taller since she's moved to the Midwest. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. You should follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest, and you should tweet conundrums to us and also email conundrums to us at gabfest@slate.com, and come to our conundrum show on December 12th in New York. Tickets at slate.com/live. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Have a really happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you next week.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.